Unconditional deals with mature themes. Parental discretion is advised.
When I was a teenager, I heard the Metropolitan Opera on the radio for the first time. It was just for me. So I didn't have a music background and I didn't come from a musical family. And so I started to take classical lessons. I still very much like singing, but once this trauma happened with my younger son, I just haven't felt like singing since. The depth of the sorrow that you feel when your child has done something very wrong. I mean, it's not like a little thing. It's not like he took somebody's pail in the sandbox, right? He's taken somebody's life. And I just can't really express the depth of my sorrow for that action, for him and for the young woman who innocently, you know, not that there's any reason to take somebody's life, but she was above reproach in every way. And that's with me always and will always be there.
I'm Annalisa Nielsen, and this is Unconditional, a podcast about what it's like to be a mother whose child is sent to prison. Dinny grew up in San Jose, California, during the time of the Vietnam War.
And it was all black and white. And I'm a very gray person. And so things in the United States, well, they just didn't really feel comfortable for me.
So after graduating from college, Dinny moved to Vancouver to do graduate school. She made the decision to study social work because, as she tells it, the social work building had a better view of the water and the mountains.
Then I thought, okay, I can daydream here. I've worked in mental health. I've worked sometimes in child welfare. And now I'm retired.
Dinny and her husband, Barry, met while working at Children's Aid.
It was just so simpatico, like we just overlapped.
Dinny and Barry had to meet one day to discuss one of Dinny's clients.
So I met him in the parking lot one day and I said, when are we ever going to get together and talk about ta-da-da-da? And he said, well, how about Thursday night at your place? And he said, I'll bring the wine. And I said, well, I'll have cheese. And so he came to my place that night. We did talk about the client for about 30 seconds to a minute. And then I sang for him. He was working on a book. He read to me. I told him about my problems with my boyfriend at the time. He told me he'd never treat me like that. And proposed.
Barry had been planning a trip to Europe, and he suggested that Dinny come with him so they could get married there. The couple were married in Ireland and spent the next 3 months on their honeymoon exploring France.
Then we came back and Barry was doing a project for the Writers Union and I went back to work and I guess that lasted a year or so. And then I said, okay, I'm ready to have a baby. You have to get a job. So he went back to work and we had our first baby who was beautiful. Alan was very beautiful. Everybody thinks they have a beautiful baby, and it's quite true. I've only ever seen one ugly baby in my life. And he was a terrific kid, and then when he was 6 or 7, he started to become very ill, and by 8, he was diagnosed with childhood schizophrenia. One psychiatrist that I heard talked about how would you define schizophrenia? And he defined it as a living death. And I think that captured, you lose the person who's there originally. You do have another person and you get to know that person. We wouldn't trade Alan for anybody. He's a very amazing man. But you have a child who's there and then in the illness, they really disappear. I mean, at the time that Alan was very ill, he had talked in very long sentences, complex sentences. And when he was sick, he could not put a full sentence together.
When Alan was 4, Barry and Dinny welcomed their second son, Brian.
And he was quite different. All this boy wanted was to be up on his feet. And he was just coordinated. I don't really quite know where he came from because I'm not athletic. And Barry's not really either. And then Barry got him into baseballs. And so he was on baseball teams. And he was on the local baseball team. And then he was on the, I don't know, what's it called? Like the team that's more whatever. And then when he was at York one year, he was on the baseball team. So I got to sit behind home plates in the Sky Dome. And watch him pitch and watch him strike people out. And I watched him bat and I watched him get on base. It was so exciting.
Dinny and Barry are very intellectual, academic people. They're always talking about the latest book that they read or a play that they went to see or a talk that they just went to. When the kids were growing up, Barry was in a course at the University of Toronto in Dante's Inferno.
Basically, it's about what various popes have done wrong. So which level of hell do they go to? So we used to have those kind of things at the dinner table. So, you know, you could line up your teachers and who would you say wouldn't be in hell at all, but who would be at a deep level of hell and who would be at just a little level of hell. So those kind of evaluations of who you liked and for what reason and why. We would have sort of political and civic discussions as well, you know. But if it was more recent, we probably would have talked a lot about, say, the Rob Ford. And right now, of course, we'd be talking about Hillary and Trump, which we do talk about with both of them now. And then a lot of kind of like religious kind of thing. Do you believe in God? Or how do you believe the world did start? Or are you interested in outer space? Which, again, one of the reasons this is so hard is my son has done something that I would not have guessed or predicted. I don't know violence in his history. Here he's done really the most terrible thing that you can do. And I look back and I think, no, this is the boy who on his way to high school, you know, there was a drunk who'd collapsed in the laneway. Brian would go and see to them and then he would call 911 and he would stay with him until the EMS people and the police got there and then he would go. So that's what I know about Brian.
Is all the good stuff that I know that Brian did in the past suddenly wiped out by this? No, that's part of his history as well.
When he did this act, whatever was going on, I mean, maybe drugs and alcohol had something to do with it. Maybe his own past traumas.
For example, Brian was only 3 or 4 when his older brother got really sick with schizophrenia. But these early childhood traumas, they didn't really manifest until later. Brian seemed really okay until he was in his early teens, and then he started having some troubles.
He was having a lot of conflict with Barry and I at that point. And then at one point, he told me that he was just unhappy all the time and was thinking about suicide. So I asked him if he felt he wanted to get some help for that. He wanted to get help. And so we took him for an assessment, and he was assessed with anxiety and depression.
For me, all of these things have played out in this sorrowful event.
Not an excuse, but an understanding. And there's a difference between excuse and understanding that people often don't make.
As he got older, Brian began to develop addiction problems. He had some problems with alcohol, but he also started getting into coke as well. These addictions had really reached their peak when he committed his crime.
Brian had cravings for about 3 years, and he's not having any cravings anymore. So that must be nice.
And in that way, it must feel better. Like, where was his jail? Was it when he was beholden to alcohol and cocaine? Or is he now, he's got this real jail, but how much, you know, how much does jail feel like jail? If, I mean, you're in prison. If you're beholden to a substance, you imprison yourself. Anyway, he's clean. He hasn't had any drugs or alcohol except for his psychiatric medication. And he could have whatever he wanted. And he doesn't want. So maybe this has saved him from dying.
Although Dinny has this feeling that maybe being sent to prison might have saved Brian's life, her feelings about the Canadian justice system are pretty complicated.
The world is... it's a fluky place, but I do think that if we love and care about people, the world could be a better place than it is, than what we're doing now. And that if the Canadian people really want to feel safer, they really need to look at what we do with people after we incarcerate them. Everybody in jail is basically a throwaway person. All we care about is that we don't have to see them anymore. And it's terribly expensive.
She's not wrong. According to the most recently available statistics, each person in a federal prison in Canada costs about $115,000 each year. And those numbers are a few years old, so we can probably assume that number is even higher by now.
The higher the security, the more the person costs. And the higher the recidivism rate is going to be when they get out. We're paying a lot of money year after year after year for failure. And we want it to be that way. So that brings me to revenge, that it's really not about doing your time. We're really into that we want people punished. And, you know, I don't think the present system is really very good for victims. It seems to me that victims and their families go through this court procedure. But then every time the person comes up that they might be let out, they get notified again and they come back again. How do you ever put anything behind you and move on?
Dinny actually has some really personal experience and insight into the subject.
I was assaulted when I was young, when I was in graduate school. And the man who assaulted me 3 weeks later did a similar assault on a girl who was younger and a bit lighter than I was and killed her. And I've been thinking about it in many, many ways. I don't think it would have been good for me to go back there all the time and to see him. My assault was called an indecent assault. I had some clothes ripped off me and grabbed from behind and pulled back. And I was also in a car. So what I was able to do was to kick the car door open and kick my feet up and down outside the door to draw outside attention. And that is what stopped it. When I went back to the hearing, his father came, and people were saying very loudly, especially the victim's mother was saying very loudly, you know, I could never raise a child like that. So I went over to have a chat with him and to tell him that not everybody had the same. I didn't view him as a bad parent, even though I had had this terrible experience with his son. Now I'm kind of on the other side of this same kind of story. And I think how, I know this won't really be good for Brian, but I don't see how it's good for the victim and the victim's family.
When I heard this story about Dinny's attack, I just couldn't imagine reconciling this dichotomy between being a woman who is the victim of a violent act and also being the mother to a son who commits violence against women.
When we came to my son's, to Brian's crime, what have I done that has made him think that a woman is not to be respected, or that you can have what you want from a woman, even if she says no, because she was saying no. And how could he grow up in this family and not get it, you know, not get that, you know? I mean, he's not seen Barry treat me in this kind of way. That hasn't been there. But there must be an element of that, or he couldn't have done it, right? I don't get it. And I've been searching for years through the family dysfunction, and we're not a perfect family. There's not a family out there that doesn't have something, because we're weak, vulnerable human beings. Have I always been a perfect mother? No. Has Barry always been a perfect father? No. Have we always been a perfect couple? No. But have we been good enough? I think so. I love my son just as much as the victim's family love their daughter. And I feel terrible for them and for their daughter just as much as I feel sad for my son for what he did, and also for the outcome of his life.
Brian is currently serving a life sentence for first-degree murder, and he'll be eligible for parole after 25 years. This is the maximum sentence that he could have gotten in Canada.
It would help if he had some memory of what happened, but he has no memory of it at all. So everything he knows about what happened, the information really has come from the police and forensics. So that's very hard, too. I mean, he can't make sense out of what happened, but just knows that he will have to do his, his, like, trying to be good to people in the future to put it right, because he says, how can I ever account for this? How can I ever make up for this? I can't bring somebody back. I mean, if he could blow into her and bring her back to life, that's what he would do.
Denny's understanding of what happened on the night of the crime is partially from Brian and then pieced together from what she learned from forensics and from the police.
What I understand from Brian is that he did some grocery shopping, he did some shopping for his medications, and got some beer, and he came back to his place, he drank a couple of beer. Then he went out to the local place, I guess beer or alcohol place, and ordered a pitcher of beer. What Brian says is he filled up his pitcher with beer again, and that other people shared some other cocktails with him. But none of that could be verified.
Basically, in Brian's version of the story, he drank a lot more alcohol.
Then he went home, got a glass of water, went to bed, and had kind of a restless sleep.
This is basically where Brian's memory from that night ends.
Then he learned that the person knocked on her door and asked to use the cell phone, and also that his DNA was there, that there had been no penetration, but there was his DNA on her abdomen. So then he's trying to make sense out of this.
Brian doesn't really have an explanation for why he would have gone to knock on this girl's door. She was a girl who lived in his residence building, and he knew her from around. He assumes that he probably went to her door to ask to borrow her cell phone so that he could get in touch with his coke dealer.
That's really as far as we've gotten. Whether that's correct or not, we don't know, but it could be. And he was there. He remembers earlier in the day, and he doesn't remember being there earlier in the day, because his DNA could be there any time from her last shower, right? So it could have been the day before, even. But he doesn't remember being there earlier in the day. So that puts him there at the time of the crime. And where I've come to see that I can't have any other explanation how this happened. So that's what I've come to see.
In the time between the crime and the arrest, the police had been questioning Brian, and they got a warrant to search Denny's house. During one of my visits with Denny, she picked up this little picture frame off her piano And it was just one of these small dollar store picture frames. It was green, has pink flowers on it. Inside is a little picture of a tulip. And Dinny told me this story about how when the police came to search the house, she was understandably anxious and nervous. She reached out and grabbed this picture frame just to have something to hold, something familiar, something to comfort her. She was about to leave and the policeman barked at her that she had to drop it because nothing in the house belonged to her anymore. So she set it down on the main floor of her house where she found it. And later, when she was finally allowed back in the house, she found the picture frame buried underneath of a bunch of other things in the basement. While her family waited for the police investigation to wrap up, Dinny and Brian went to stay with some friends.
We were together. We watched her parents come in at the airport. Brian's thing was, oh my God, look at her parents. Look at how sad they are. Can you imagine? I said, I can't imagine. And one of the reporters said to the parents, you know, they've just arrested somebody. And I was like, they've arrested somebody. Oh, okay, well, they found that it was somebody else, at which point they knocked on the door and came in and arrested Brian. So the TV station knew about his arrest before, just a bit before it happened. I mean, I could go on for a long time about many aspects of this, but really the main thing that I think about and that comes up all the time is that as a parent, you just continue to love your kid and want the best for your kid or some kind of life for your kid. And it's certainly not the life for either one of my children that I had envisioned for them when I was pregnant. Both a major mental illness and losing a son to the prison system, they're both losses. And they're both losses of what is your understanding of what your child is like. I felt one child, I thought I knew, and then he was gone to mental illness. And Brian, I thought I knew. And then suddenly there's this thing that changes him into somebody that I don't know at all. But what I keep coming back to is, you know, you could say, can your child do something that's so bad that you stop loving them? And I guess I have to come to to know.
Unconditional is produced by me, Annalisa Nielsen. A huge thank you to Dinny and her family. Music by Chad Crouch, aka Poddington Bear. Special thanks goes to Louise Leonardi of the Canadian Families and Corrections Network. This episode was made possible by Paula Flalo, Lauren Bridle, and the rest of my classmates in the documentary media program at Ryerson University. Thank you to Vid Ingelvicks and Don Snyder for consultation assistance and mastering courtesy of Eric Strom.